Spence and Lila Culpepper have been married for more than 40 years. They have 3 grown children and 5 grandchildren. Lila has to go into the hospital for a mastectomy, and the story of how she and her husband and family cope with this crisis forms the backbone of a new novel, Spence plus Lila, written by my guest Bobby Ann Mason. Mason is also the author of Shiloh and Other Stories and the novel In Country. She writes both fiction and nonfiction for The New Yorker magazine. Bobby Ann Mason's work has received high praise from the urban literary establishment, although all of her work is a reflection of the people and places she knew when she was growing up in rural Kentucky. In her book, Spence plus Lila, Spence Culpepper is a soybean farmer.
Spence and Lila have a small farm, and when Spence goes up in a little airplane, his neighbor takes him up, he can see his farm whole in a way he's never seen it before. And I think I'm aware as a reader that that Spence's farm is surrounded by the suburbs, the subdivisions, industry, highways, and that it's a way of life that's endangered as well as a life in this book.
It's a rural life that is being almost infringed by modern urban values?
I take special care, though, not to romanticize that sort of life. It's a hard life, and people like Spence and Lila are quite, they welcome electricity and the washing machine and things like that that they have seen in their lifetime take the place of some of the tedious chores they've had to do. So it's a complex thing. There are things about modern life to feel thankful for and things that make it more confusing. And I like to write about people who live within certain terms and maybe are defined by those terms, but have a great amount of dignity within those limits. The limits that maybe society sets on them or the economy.
You just mentioned economic in terms of limits, but it also reminded me of economy in terms of writing. At one point in the book, Spence is trying to articulate the way that he feels about Lila, and everything that he says starts sounding like movie dialogue and television dialogue. And there's one line that it says, using simple words at the right time requires courage.
I was taught not to waste anything, and I wasn't taught to be effusive in my speech. And I recognize Spence's tendencies.
It did sound like a motto you might put up above your computer screen, you know, as you're writing. Oh, yes, right. You know. Be short, succinct, and to the point.
Yeah.
This is the first long piece you've written really since your novel In Country. Mm-hmm. You're usually writing short stories and so forth. Was it as difficult for you to get into the form this time as it may have been the first time you had to tackle it?
No, this was a very natural story for me to write. And when I wrote In Country, it was a great, big, overwhelming, intimidating, blank set of pages that I had to explore. This is a pretty straightforward narrative.
In Country's being made into a movie.
Oh, yes.
Have you been visiting the set down in Kentucky?
I've seen the sets and met some of the people, and I'm extremely impressed and very enthusiastic about the whole thing.
This must be, you know, really something for you.
Well, down there in western Kentucky, the whole place is going kind of crazy, I understand. They're so excited that a movie is being made right there at home.
Are you treated like a star when you go home now? I mean, after all, here's this movie being made of the local writer.
Because of the movie, yeah. Not before, probably. But the movie is really made a big difference. I went to my high school reunion 2 or 3 weeks ago, and that was a very strange thing to do, because I got so much attention. You know, in high school, I was so shy that I hardly had any friends, and all of a sudden, they were all paying attention to me.
Is it hard for you to talk about your writing?
Well, I think it's ought to speak for itself, and it's kind of hard to stand back from it and talk about it in any kind of abstract or analytical terms. Fiction is about it's a story, and it's about feeling, and it's about characters, and the problems of writing, and the way I would talk about my writing are in terms of what comes alive, and how do you feel about the characters, and what the language is doing. And I know in graduate school I learned to read books in an entirely different way, but I read more now from the point of view of a writer.
What is that point of view?
Well, it's, like I said, more in terms of the language and the technique and the life and the story and real things in the story, not abstractions like theme or meaning or symbol or motif or any kinds of concepts. That those are really not what you think about when you're imagining a story and getting the textures of these characters' lives. And that's not really what... You're not really thinking about theme when you're reading. You're thinking about what's happening.
And what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
So
as a writer, I think I, anyway, experience the process quite literally. In this book, I'm really interested in what these characters are doing during this particular crisis and what they're eating and what they're feeling about each other.
There's almost a visual image then, is there, when you're writing it down? You must see the kitchen where he's standing or the hospital corridor where he's walking down.
Yeah. I felt that. I don't know that I'm always so visual, but
Have you seen this?
No.
It's a picture of your cats.
Oh, great.
Did you write that little essay that accompanies
the... Did you read it?
I read the first part, but I didn't...
This is the funny part.
Go ahead, you read it. It's from Life magazine. You wrote it, you read it.
Should I read the whole thing?
Sure, go ahead.
In the 1970s, when I moved to a farm, there were suddenly cats. My sister, Linnell Mason, snapped this photo at feeding time one summer day. There are 9 cats in the picture and 1 cat off stage with a special diet plate. That's Blackie with his head in the bucket. Judy, the calico next to him, is the mother of the 4 cats in the middle of the picture. Bilbo, Bubbles, and Alice were one litter, and Gandalf, the little black one with the white bib, was an only kitten. Gandalf had all the classic traits of an only child. In the foreground, black and white Galahad came from a neighbor, exchanged for one of Judy's orange kittens. Nanochka has long white fur, and just beside her, barely visible in a ghostly parallel, is Norris, her brother. Blackie, the strong, silent type, was the king, but Judy was the one who actually ran things. That summer, 2 young gray tigers, Albert and Alfred, showed up. When they sneaked up to the dishes, Judy hissed and growled. Albert and Alfred were handsome and thin and amiable enough, but every day Judy chased them out across the field. I decided that Albert and Alfred would be much less threatening if I took them to the vet to be neutered. Although confused and surprised, they recovered quickly from their little operations. I let them out after a day or so, and right away Judy chased them past the barn. I never saw them again. I always imagined Alfred and Albert returning to their original home and trying to explain what had happened to them. Judy's now 16 and just about retired. Her children, Bilbo and Alice, and her exchange cat, Galahad, are still with us.
Oh, you look so happy that's there.
I'm thrilled with this.
It's lovely. Bobby Ann Mason, thanks very much for coming by.
I enjoyed this.
You can see the picture of Bobby Ann Mason's cats in the new issue of Life magazine. Her novel, Spence Plus Lila, is published by Harper & Row. This is Fresh Air.